There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
The TV Time Machine. Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to embark on a journey to a simpler time. An era before VCRs, digital cable, DVD players, and satellite receivers. A period of history whose innocence and simplicity was reflected in the shows we watched and the characters we all enjoyed. I'm Jim Benson. Join me, if you will, on a nostalgia-filled trip as we climb aboard the TV Time Machine. Our destination subject today will be the history of technology on TV. Editor-in-Chief of Scientific American magazine, John Rennie, will help navigate this particular excursion into the annals of classic television. We'll begin our exciting and fun-filled odyssey right after these brief messages. Today on the TV Time Machine, we reboot our timely transportation to keenly examine the impact of technology on television. Over the past five decades, television has influenced every quarter of our world, and the various sciences, mechanisms, and contrivances depicted on the small screen inevitably shape our personal habits, our economies, and ultimately our futures. Within the context of mass entertainment, television technology has proven to be both accurate and prescient, reflecting our ever-changing present while guiding a light toward an exciting technological road to the future. While shining a light on the aforementioned topic, we offer a midnight special to add a little credence to our program in the form of a most distinguished guest, Editor-in-Chief of Scientific American magazine, John Rennie. Mr. Rennie is only the seventh editor-in-chief in the remarkable 161-year history of the magazine, and also presently serves as editor-in-chief of Scientific American Mind. Over the next few segments, John Rennie will dispense with his princess phone, 8-track tape player, and his collection of licorice pizza while we probe the tantalizing topic of technology on TV, its representation in the past, and its promise for the future. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to fire up your crystal set, feel free to bask in the glow of your cathode ray tube as we slip from the restraints of the present and enter a technological world of the past and future. John Rennie, Editor-in-Chief, Scientific American Magazine.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
John, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Jim, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
How are things in the Big Apple, John?
Well, things are fine today. We're enjoying beautiful spring weather, and as such, we're ready to launch ourselves into the ghastly heat of summer, I'm sure.
Yeah, I wonder how the weather is in Massachusetts, because I understand you grew up in Massachusetts.
I did. That's where I was born, and really spent most of my life, early life, there in Massachusetts, and really most of my family is still back there in the general Boston area.
Now, while you were growing up, did you have a certain interest that led to your interest in the sciences?
Well, it's a little hard to say. I mean, I think my dad was a pilot, a test pilot in the Navy, and my mom was a nurse. That might have contributed a little bit to my being exposed to science and starting to love it. But I have to confess that I was probably raised by TV at least as much as I was by my actual family. And I really think that it was a lot of the kind of science and science-related things that I saw on television growing up in the 60s that did start to steer me towards science. I've really always strongly credited that. That's a big influence.
Presently, what fascinates you the most about science?
Well, a lot of different sorts of things about it. I think that there's a general philosophical aspect to science that's wonderful. On the one hand, there's a general philosophy, of course, that the universe can be understood, that we somehow should be able to, by applying our reason and enough cleverness in our study of it, that we should actually be able to grasp it. But nevertheless, there's, I think, just such a wondrousness and awe that it inspires. You look out into a universe and it's so inconceivably vast and so inconceivably complicated that I think there's something wonderful in a sense of seeing yourself as a tiny little atom in the vastness of that.
Yeah, what always blows me away is trying to comprehend, and you can't comprehend it, obviously, infinity. You know, we have finite minds and you can't possibly comprehend infinity.
Not in the sense of being able to encompass it, that's true. And yet the wonderful thing about, you know, mathematics and science is that even without actually necessarily being able to picture it, being able to see an infinite number of things in your head, you can still develop tools that let you sort of manipulate it. I mean, in a sense, that's the whole nature of the calculus, is that you're dealing with infinite numbers of infinitesimally small things, yet you add those up and it lets you actually calculate things like the exact area under a curve or the exact amount of distance that's been covered by something moving through space.
Now, what events led to you joining Scientific American magazine and eventually becoming its editor-in-chief?
Well, you know, I was traveling with the gypsy wagon train, and I fell off here in New York, and I ended up in the step here.
That's the usual story, yeah.
But that's a longer story. I had studied biology as an undergraduate at Yale, and I had decided rather than go on and pursue actually getting a research degree in neuroscience, which is something that interested me a lot in those days back in the 70s, I thought I would really like to write about it. So I started a ragtag kind of career writing for different sorts of newsletters and freelancing for various magazines. And a tremendous break came my way one day when there happened to be an opening at Scientific American, and I applied with really absolutely no confidence at all that I could ever managed to be accepted at a magazine like this, and it turned out that I had a sort of strange knack for being able to take the manuscripts that the scientists would turn in, which, as you could imagine, are sometimes rather incomprehensible,
yes.
And I could manage to turn them into Scientific American articles, and, well, I've been here at the magazine since then.
What is the publishing philosophy of Scientific American?
Well, that's a good question. Hardly ever asked about a publishing philosophy. I think generally what our idea is that we're trying to put out a magazine for people who have a sincere interest in wanting to understand science in some depth, and they're reasonably well educated in science, but they also they are ultimately lay people in these different areas. They want to know what's happening in lots of different areas, rather than, say, just looking at for one specialty magazine. If all they were interested in was astronomy, there are other specific astronomy magazines. But, Scientific American, we have astronomy and biology and physics and material science and really pretty much any other area of science that you could name.
Where do you see your magazine 10 years from now?
That is a really complicated question. Because, of course, what's the great challenge for all magazines these days is we're all trying to grapple with what the rise of the digital era means. And I think one of the big questions is, I think all of us assume that 5-10 years from now, a very significant number of readers will probably prefer to get their magazines in an electronic form. And the real question is, what does that mean? Do you want to have a magazine that is just a replica of what you're doing on paper, or should you be able to do more taking advantages of multimedia? How do you handle something like that? There are a lot of different ways in which that can go, a lot of questions about how you make it pay for itself, and that's something that we're all working with. And if you're putting out a science and technology magazine, the issues of that are maybe particularly to the fore.
I think a lot of media is struggling with that right now, whether it's print media, whether it's radio, television, because of the advent of the Internet, all of this seems to be converging.
I think that's right. You know, convergence has sort of become the magic buzzword at times, and I think some of us are almost sick of sometimes hearing it, but I think it's the reality. There's really no getting past it. You know, the Internet and print and TV and radio are all coming together in all sorts of ways, and, you know, for example, just look at the fact that now you can download any number of different TV shows and watch them on an a la carte basis. That's a gigantic transformation in the whole nature of how television can be presented to us. And really, that's just the beginning of that. I think we're looking at the potential for some gigantic upheavals in television as we've known it.